5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the new Panic Room. It's the show other shows want to be, and the show that authors want to be on. The all-new Panic Room radio show is brought to you by HellboundBooks.com.
Well, good evening. It is the new Panic Room, episode 187 on, and I'm going to have to check the date again, what promises to be the 7th, or what has been, in effect, in many ways, the 7th of May 2020, or as I now call it, in the after times, where we all yearn for the before times, before coronavirus and the whole world went to hell in a handbasket. But here we are, you know, through global pandemic, economic meltdown, we're still doing this nonsense. So it's a little, I like to think, a little vein of sanity running through all the nonsense. But and big thank the tune we played there from our good friend and fantastic author Carlos Colon and his Roustabouts. It's his first new single in a number of years now. It's about 2-3 years now. He really needs to do a lot more, actually, because I have his album. Although he did make me pay for it, to be honest, which, you know, bless him. But one of my favorites on my playlist. So Diamond Pocket from Carlos Colon there. And I know he's listening. Carlos, we love you. Thank you so much. Absolute honor to be able to play that on the show tonight. But moving, so, and I know she's itching, which is a different story, itching to get on. We better bring her on.
Before the show and kind of dragging, but I hear that and I perk right up and now I'm smiling and yay. So and I'm not even drinking yet.
Maybe you should not. I've had a tiring day as well today. I thought, oh, should I just cancel the show and I'll crawl into bed. But yeah, then like you say, the theme tune starts off and you know it's like, no, damn it, you know, we Our listener, bless him, he depends on us, you know. But with the one little ray of sunshine in his mother's basement, you know. So so there's that. And as I say, I mean, great to hear a new one from Carlos and the boys. You know, they really should do more. But I was jiving around my desk here. It was fun. It's been a day. It's just been one thing. You know, you have a whole list of things planned, and then you have a really busy day. You do lots and lots of stuff, and then you go back to your list, and you've done nothing that was on the list. I've had one of those. I've completed another list of stuff that I hadn't planned to complete, but not that. And I thought, oh, there's always tomorrow. But you know, it's just like, when is this going to get done? Really, you know.
Well, now what you do is you write down all the things that you did complete just to cross them off. So it looks like you did.
I do that. It's funny enough, that was a tip I picked up on a time management course I went on many, many years ago. And the guy said, you know, because, you know, he was always big on making lists and checking. And it's a psychological, I'll do it, you know, putting a list together and I'll just jot something on that I've done. you know, yeah, just yeah. so I could put a line through it. And it just, it's oh, geez,
better.
Oh,
yeah.
The garlic
yeah,
oh, thank
put,
you.
And you have
salt. I've just been brought, oh, yes, I've been brought some nice garlic toast. Phenomenal. Well, I'm excited now. I'm going to eat toast on the air, which is great. Thank you. I said, whoa, bless Grace. Brilliant. Oh, bless him. So, yeah, it's been, anyway, and again, I know people have been worried. I mean, we have Donald Trump on the show quite a bit, but of course, everybody in the world thought this guy was dead. They thought he was dead, and he's risen phoenix-like, or maybe he's even Lazarus-like from the afterlife. And well, just have him pop in, I think.
대회를 앞두고 경제 발전과 인민 생활 향상에 크게 이바지할 수 있는 수많은 주요 대상 건설을 짧은 기간에 훌륭히 완공하고 당 중앙에 중종의 보고서들을 보내어 왔습니다.
So, welcome back, Kim Jong-un. We missed you. God bless him. God bless him. He's back live and kicking. And actually, that was actually him reciting his mother's recipe for linguine. So, you know, but in obviously North
yeah.
Korean. But, yeah, so why can't Donald Trump do that? Why can't he just fuck off for a week, you know, just leave us in peace for a bit? There's a thought. If you,
yeah.
And I know Donald listens in, so... Thoughts and prayers, Donnie. You know, take a leaf out of Kim's book and seriously just piss off for a week. Just let us have a week where press conferences
you know.
Make sense and the country's run by an adult, not some fat orange turd of a child man, you know?
But, you know, I think I would be more afraid that when he did, if he did take some time off and come back in like a week or so, that he would have like powered up somehow, you know? Some kind of dark forces, you know, he'd power up. I kind of just, you know, we have to be able to see where he's at all times and know what, you know, what he's doing.
I suppose, yeah, I suppose he's like a 2-year-old, you know,
yeah.
If you can't see them,
Donnie.
They're
yeah.
up to something.
Yeah.
What is Donnie, he's got his head stuck down the toilet again. Donnie's playing in the cat litter tray again. Donnie, get out of that. Donnie, stop it. Stop it. Don't put that on your nose. Donnie, no. Stop. No. That's naughty. Don't. Get that
God.
Out of your bottom.
Yeah, so that's why he can't, you know, he can't go away for a week. Yeah.
I think that's very, very wise, actually, because, yes, he's dangerous enough when we can see what he's doing.
Yes.
But, yeah. Well, hopefully, again, voting public, you know, come November, he will piss off for good. That would be great. That would really just be fun. It would help erase the past 4 years of absolute hell. So, and this is the point of the show. We introduce our first guest, who is an ardent Trump supporter. So that will happen one day. Somebody's going to come on and say, Donald Trump's the best thing since sliced bread, motherfucker. You know, it would be a lively show. It would be a lively show. It really would.
It almost always is, I think. You know, we do a pretty good job, I think. So is this where I tell people where our guest for the night? Is that my cue?
Sorry, I'm eating my toast. My son brought me some garlic toast for his minute. I'm going to reek like a Frenchman's armpit tomorrow, but this is good.
Oh, God.
This is good. This is brilliant. I like it. So, hey, Xena. Oh, I'm going to press this button because there's stuff going on. Here we go.
Into a week in the morning and I step outside and I take a distance and I get free. Top of my lungs, what's going on? In our family.
Xtina, what is going on?
Oh, a whole bunch of stuff and things. Very, very important things and important
things,
stuff.
Bigly
and,
things, bigly things.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Yeah. No, I don't know. What is going on, James?
Well, tomorrow we are launching the sequel to Ghost Spirits and Spectres, which is rather inventively called Ghost Spirits and Spectres Volume 2, which we had so many phenomenal submissions for the anthology that we produced a second volume, and it is released tomorrow. It goes live tomorrow, so, you know, some
Yay.
Phenomenal...
You know,
I know you're a big fan of ghost stories. Phenomenal
I
ghost
am.
Stories on there. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to have to get some of the guys on to, you know, to
yes,
come on.
Yes, you must,
the show.
Yeah. There's some absolute spine chillers. So, yeah. So buy the book, people.
Yeah.
Buy the book. So, you know, we can eat. That'll be great. So, and in the vein of what's going on, what have we got on the show this evening?
Yay. I'm excited on our show tonight. Our first guest, we have USA Today bestselling author Jennifer Benet. And later on in the show, we have horror writer Jonathan Dingens. So,
phenomenal.
Yes,
I would have said Jennifer Bean, but, you know, I'm foreign, so I can get away with that. So I think without further ado, you should bring her on.
All righty. Our first guest, USA Today bestselling author Jennifer Benet. Woo!
Jennifer, good evening.
Good evening.
Hello,
Yay.
How are you? Thank you for joining us.
I'm glad to be here. I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, I was doing well, and I'm doing even better now because my son, totally unprompted, brought me some homemade garlic toast what he'd made. So, my evening's really on the up now. I'm just so what we need to do, we need to get you talking so I can finish my toast. You know? So, Jennifer, you're here to talk to us about your book, Imperfect Monster. There's no tagline on here, so obviously, actually, it couldn't be bothered.
This
so,
is a tagline
you know.
List. Double, yeah. This is a tagline list show today. Our second guest didn't have one either, so we're just... No taglines
fine.
Today. Yeah.
That's our hook this week, is it? No tagline. So, Jennifer,
exactly.
tell us something about it.
You know, I primarily write dark romance, and when Xtina reached out to me, I asked her, based on your show's listeners, what would they like to hear about, and she picked this one. Imperfect Monster came out a while ago. I don't even remember when, actually, but it was a BookBub editor's top pick when it was released. It's one that people like to enjoy, and the bonus of covering this one on your show today is that it is a standalone, and so if no one's tried my work before, this is something they can try out and not be sucked into a series.
Now, I was caught with you know, dark romance. I have, I think, a couple of, wow, it must have been at least 5 years ago now, I stumbled upon the dark romance genre. And I think my first read was, oh, goodness. Oh, what was that? C.J. Roberts, Captive. I think Captive in the Dark was my first dark romance. And I actually had it on my Kindle for a good month before I started reading it because I was scared. I didn't know what I was, you know, I had no idea what the dark romance, you know, the whole genre was. And, I thought it was amazing, and after that, I could not get enough of dark romance. So, is that? I mean, is that all you write is dark romance? I mean, what kind of? I guess what appeals to you about the dark romance stuff?
Well, I will say C.J. Roberts' Captive in the Dark was one of my first reads that were officially in the genre when it was a baby genre that I don't even think it had the dark romance name at the time. I think that came out a little while later. It was broadcast as romantic suspense. And so, and that's still how it's mostly categorized on Amazon because they won't create a dark romance category. But it's one of those things where I think there is a core in many, many women across the world, and some men too, that enjoy this idea of, you know, someone wanting you and craving you enough to take you, that whole captive genre.
Yeah.
Used to show up in those Harlequin bodice rippers where the pirate took the nice lady. And it's just evolved into contemporary romance. You know, as historical faded and contemporary took over, it translated into this more modern stalker obsession or kidnap captive genre that blackmail you into a relationship type thing. And it's something that's wonderfully freeing in fiction, because of course we wouldn't want these things to happen to us in real life, but it's quite thrilling when it happens in a romance novel.
The Harlequin romance, I think probably the same sort of thing we had in England. We have Mills and Boone, which was the good old, a lot of period drama, the bodice rippers, and it was always, like you say, the pirate or the highwayman or the gardener, obviously, Lady Chatterley, you know, making a bad girl out of it. And I guess it really, you know, yes, it's great fantasy, and it probably illustrates Stockholm Syndrome to a T. But, I mean, it is
right.
Big. I mean, it's interesting. You said Amazon won't create a dark romance category. Is that a deliberate policy, do you know?
Well, seeing as how I am not on a first name basis with Jeff Bezos, I don't really know their reasoning behind it, but it's definitely something that is searched frequently. It's an extremely popular and growing genre. And I think we're all still hoping that someday they'll cave and make one.
It's very big for the monopoly that they have, you know, that they are. It is. It's very big brother that, you know, they can dictate what they think is acceptable and what isn't. It's like Facebook, I guess. You know, we are bit by bit being herded, I'm afraid. But
true.
Yeah, I mean, dark romance. We publish some, you know, dark, very dark romance stuff, and it is incredibly popular. I mean, it's a terrific genre. I mean, I'm not a big romance read, as you can imagine, but the dark romance stuff, I love that.
See,
I'm not a romantic exciner, I'll tell you that.
And I guess I want to know from you, do you think there is too far? Do you think there's have you read any that you think is, wow, I think they went too far, they stepped over the line in this one? Have you ever thought that?
I haven't, but I'm a terrible person. I'm probably the book you're referring to more often than not. I definitely tend towards the darker end of things. Obviously, all of my characters are always adults. And unless it's in the horror category, because I do have some books that fall into that horror subgenre, there's always a happy ending. And I like redeeming the anti-hero. I think it's a fun challenge to take the not so shining, not knight in very rusted armor and show how in fiction that person can change. I do not think a woman should ever try to change a man in real life, because it's not going to work. But in fiction, it works wonderfully.
Yeah. You know, speaking again about C.J. Roberts, you know, when we start out, we kind of hate Caleb, you know, and then I love the epilogue. So by the epilogue, I was totally in love with him, and he was still an asshole. You know, I mean, he hadn't changed into this wonderful person, but we liked him. You know, we definitely liked him, which, you know, in something for, I guess, something a little different with Pepper Winters, when she did what was it called? The Monsters in the Dark, with Q, you know, I mean, even though we don't like him at first, we kind of find out that all along he's been this good guy. We just know it, you know, so, I mean, like, it's definitely different. And I like the bad boy. I do. I want a bad guy. That's awful to say, but it's true.
Well, I mean, that's, I think, the allure of this genre. I think having a dangerous, dark anti-hero that craves you so much is just, it's enticing, it's intoxicating, and it's something that we all have that dark inner fantasy about, like probably pulling back to our lizard brain Neanderthal days. we want someone to want us enough to knock us over the head and drag us off.
Yes, I like that.
Just not in real life.
Right.
Just that Xena's getting excited. Don't get overexcited, please.
I am. I'm excited because I read up a little bit or down a little bit, whatever, of the excerpt and some of the things I saw. Like, I cannot wait. So, do you have an excerpt for it?
I do. You picked the dirtiest excerpt I sent you.
I did.
Oh, how out of character, I have to say.
I did. It's good. It is. So
I mean,
do you
want me to read it?
Yes, ma'am.
If you need to set it up, and then off you go.
I think I will set it up just a little bit because it comes about probably a third of the way through the book. I'll read the blurb for the book so that you get kind of a vague understanding of the characters. The blurb is, cold, ruthless, vicious. I'm Paolo Garcia's monster, and I've swallowed that bitter pill whole. Learned to deal with it until she stormed into the house like some avenging Valkyrie. Brave, stupid, beautiful. Nikki just wants to save her brother. She showed up with an envelope full of cash and a smart mouth and found herself in a den of monsters. I wish I could say I was the best of them. I wish I could say I wanted to protect her, but I'm far from perfect, and she's so damn sweet. And all I want is a taste before this world destroys her.
Okay, now put the dirty stuff.
I know, swoon-worthy, right?
Let the steam begin.
Yes. And so basically that is what happens. The character Nikki shows up at what ends up being a drug lord compound in Miami, and she's mouthing off because she doesn't really realize the trouble she's in. She just wants her brother to kind of not owe the man money anymore because he got put in the hospital. And the drug lord kind of agrees, like, okay, well, we won't bother your brother anymore, but we're keeping you.
I gotta say, when you said she's mouthing off, I'm like, yes, I love the strong, you know, the sassy. I hate that when I read one of these books and the woman is all weak and I just, because I would mouth off. So I love that.
You would enjoy my books then. I have very strong female protagonists. And in this scene, Andre already sort of saved her from some of the other guys in the house, and he has her locked in his room in the mansion to kind of keep all the other guys away from her. But really, she's only safe from everyone else, not from Andre. So this scene happens after he had to go out on a job. All right, here is the excerpt from Imperfect Monster. Nikki, open the door. It was Andre's voice, and I shoved a scrap of paper I'd snagged into the book to mark my place and left it on the bedside table before moving to the door. I fumbled with shaking hands through the locks, but finally opened it, and he pushed both me and the door aside as he walked in. I caught the masculine scent of sweat and the outside as he brushed past, but managed to shut the door tight as soon as he was inside, redoing all of the locks. What happened? I asked, but Andre was silent, removing his guns to set them on the top of the dresser beside his closet. Then the jacket came off, and then the holster thing that wrapped across his back and chest to keep the guns against his ribs. Andre? When he turned around, I stumbled backward until my legs hit the bed behind me. He looked like he had the night before, when I was caught in that fucking chair, waiting for Paolo to decide my fate. Empty, dark brown eyes, a frightening expression on his face that sent fear thrumming through me before I could fight it. He didn't look human. Andre, I repeated, voice wavering, and he stalked forward. So tall, so broad, and when he grabbed onto my waist, I flinched. He squeezed hard, pinching my skin before he ripped my shirt over my head, forcing me to duck through the hole before he tossed it aside. Before I could even react, his hands were already at my shorts. The button popped free and the zipper down. I regretted taking my shoes off as he grabbed me under the arms and tossed me onto the bed so he could yank the shorts free. Fuck, what was wrong with him? I was afraid. No other reaction was really appropriate as he planted one knee on the end of the bed and I scrambled backward. But he caught my ankle and yanked me flat. He was still clothed, sweaty, and silent. Don't hurt me? Something in his expression faltered, but then his eyes dropped to my chest and he grabbed my shoulder to turn me onto my side so he could undo the clasp of my bra. He tossed it aside, immediately palming my breast as he straddled one of my thighs. Thumbs rolling over my nipples, I could barely process that they were already hard and peaked until I felt him tighten his grip and pinch them both. Fuck! I screamed, whimpering as the pain shot like bolts of lightning through my breast, forcing my back to arch in an effort to ease the strain. But Andre didn't back off. He twisted them further and I felt tears in my eyes, grabbing onto his shoulders and digging my nails in as if it would make him stop. Leaning over me, he bit down on my shoulder and I screamed again, pushing at his ribs as he released my tender nipples, and then he had both his legs inside of mine, spreading me, digging his knees into my thighs so I had no way to stop him. But I could barely focus as his teeth pressed in harder. Please, 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 I begged, whining when he finally took a breath and released me, his dark eyes staring at the place his mouth had just been. Then he looked between us, and he grabbed my panties, tearing the pale blue fabric as his biceps bulged. The fabric burned against my hips as he ripped it, yanking the remnants out from under me so he could throw it aside. Andre! His name didn't seem to affect him at all as he slid his fingers between my legs, forcing two of them into me where I wasn't wet in the least. I whimpered and lifted my hips off the bed, but he ran his thumb over my clit as his mouth moved to my breast, sucking on the tender bud as he stroked me below. For a minute or two, every shift of his fingers seemed to burn and ache, and then my body caught up and started to lubricate around his harsh touch. There was pleasure and pain as he opened me up, warming my body for what I knew would come next. It was almost cruel how deft his touch was, the way his thumb swirled over my clit, his mouth sucking and nipping at my breast, sending zings of sensation through my body. I wanted to fight, and I didn't. I wanted to give in, and I wanted him to take me by force. But thought was something I couldn't effectively manage as he stroked his fingers in and out, wetting them as I grew slick, as my whimpers turned to moans. Then he grabbed my thighs and bent them towards my chest, staring down at my open pussy with the look of a desperate, dangerous man. I was afraid to speak, afraid to struggle against his strength as he tucked my heels over his shoulders and opened his jeans to shove the fabric out of the way and free his cock. I had stared the night before, but in this position he somehow seemed larger, especially as he moved closer to my entrance, erection bobbing at his hips. One fist around it, I opened my mouth to argue, but he lined up and drove home hard, stealing the words away as I cried out. It was almost painful, the sudden, brutal stretch as he bottomed out in one thrust. With my body bent as it was, he slammed deep on his second drive, and I felt the sharp ache as he hit my cervix, tears burning my eyes. Please, I whimpered, reaching past my legs to dig my nails into his arms, but there was no response. Andre braced his hands on either side of my ribs, folding me as he used every inch of power in his body to fuck me. It hurt, it felt good, and I couldn't think straight as he continued to move. My breasts were short, a consequence of my ribs being compressed, and that wasn't helping the dizzying effects of his thrust. Pleasure blurred the aches and pains, making me forget the threat of the man above me as I sank into it.
Wow, that was so good. And you read it so well. Wow. You know, and I have to say, we've had, you know, authors on before and they've read the dirty parts and usually not that dirty. I have to say that was amazing. And, you know, they don't even seem to flinch when they say, you know, I read one of my poem that I wrote ages ago and it had the word cock in it. And, you know, I had read this before over and over again and I was like, no problem. I get on air and I go to say it. I swear my face turned red. I stumbled over it. I was like, oh my gosh. So I have to give you props for it. You didn't even stumble over any of those words. That was awesome.
That was fantastic, you read, Jennifer. Well done. You did read it beautifully. Without, what's the word? Without abashment. Well done.
Yes.
Well done.
I loved it.
I guess you probably get asked a lot. I mean, do you enjoy writing the steamy scenes, or did you find it? I mean, I know some people, you know, struggle with writing steam.
I am not one of those people.
You enjoy it? That's great.
Yeah, it's quite often the easiest scene for me to write, and my sex scenes are long and involved and detailed, and it's something that my fans appreciate. So I will continue.
Excellent. I'm going to have a complete list of all your books for no reason.
Of course.
No specific reason.
Research only.
Yes.
Research.
Yes.
That's right. Yes. That's what we'll call it. Research. Yeah, brilliant. I love that. So is this what draws you to the genre? Is it that you can be steamy as you want and fantasize? Or, I mean, what is it?
I think it's honestly just who I am. I mean, it's the stories that are in my brain. I'm a 100% pantser. I can't plot a story or it dies. Mm-hmm. And so these, I always say when I'm writing, it's like a movie's playing in my head and my fingers are just flying across the keyboard trying to keep up with what these characters are doing in my brain. And I'm just extremely lucky, and I'm so grateful, as I've said to my fans numerous times, that this gets to be my job and that people enjoy the crazy shit in my head. I'm very proud of
that. I totally understand
That's brilliant. It is a bizarre world that we inhabit as writers, you know. You're right. I mean, you know, people pay good money to read the crazy shit in our heads, you know, which is great. It's wonderful that you can turn that into, you know, making a living doing what you love, you know. So hats off to you. I mean, is there any genres that you would like to have a go at? Or are you happy where you are right now?
I primarily write dark romance, but I also write BDSM romance. I've been in the lifestyle for well over a decade, which we don't need to quantify. so I do love writing BDSM romance. I own a publishing company called Black Collar Press with one of my author besties, Livia Grant. And I think we are 17 books into our Blacklight series, which is based around a BDSM club. All of that is obviously all consensual and happily
ever after. Of course, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, we get her on, have you guys both on at the same time. We would have so much fun. I would love that.
Oh, that would be, yes, we can absolutely do that. That would be a hot mess. She would, we are batshit crazy when we're together. And then, of course, I do write some of the more, like, dark horror, no happy ending stuff sometimes. And that's just when I always say I need to, like, lance a dark part of my soul. And then I can go back and write something happy. But as far as the question you asked me about, like, is there something I'd really love to write? I am a hyper nerd, and I'm very proud of that. I have had this story idea on a shelf for over a decade. And it's a way more traditional fantasy novel. So no sex. It's just the whole gather the party together, go complete the quest, defeat the evil overlord.
Wow.
And it would totally work with, you know, young adult mainstream fantasy fiction. It's just I do not have an audience for that or a pen name to release that kind of book. And so it's been on the back burner for a while, but I've got some good friends in real life who have read my notes on that story, the stuff I didn't want to lose ideas for, and they want me to write it someday, and hopefully I will.
Yeah,
fantastic.
You definitely should do that.
It sounds too good to stay in your head, I have to say.
Thank you. Yeah. It's a good one, and it's got some fun feminist components, because a lot of fantasy is based around, like, the one guy that kind of realizes he's powerful and his journey, and that happens, and it's like a false start, where you see him starting to reveal his power, but then he runs into a girl who is stronger than even he is. And they have to, like, team up, but she's going to end up saving the day.
Yeah, you definitely have to write this one. I mean, you know, it could end up being like the next Harry Potter or something. I am just in awe of people who can do fantasy. That's definitely
something. I don't recall an awful lot of BDSM in Harry Potter, I have to say. So it would have made a better film, I must admit. So there's one for JK Rowling.
You've definitely not browsed fanfiction.net then, because there is plenty of BDSM Harry Potter out there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes.
To do that.
Oh, yes.
That's amazing.
This would be no sex, though. There would be nothing dirty about it. It could absolutely be for young adults. And that's part of why I've never started it, because I have other books that I owe the people who pay my bills. So someday I'll be able to do it.
Speaking of paying bills,
excellent.
I think we are just about out of time for our first segment, but Jennifer, I'd love to have you on, and I'm definitely going to get with you and have you and your partner come on the show, and because that would be amazing.
We can have a dark romance and BDSM show. That would be phenomenal.
Yes, it will.
That would be great.
So,
give
a holler out to where can we find you online? I'm all tongue-tied here.
Well, jenniferbenet.com is my website. I'm on Amazon. My books are about to hit all of the other book distributors as well. I'm working on that with my PR company. And so you're about to be able to buy them everywhere. It's just right now they're currently on Amazon. About half of them are in audio. The other half we're working on. And they're all available in ebook and paperback, though.
Great. I will get your links put up on our Facebook page. If anybody wants to stalk you, they can go there and do that. And, yes, I will be stalking you and trying to get you to come back on.
Please do.
I've had
As
so
you know,
much
I'm
fun
into
with
that.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Jennifer, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Yeah, and you have
thank
a great
you.
Rest
thank
of your
so
evening.
Much.
I will speak to you again very soon.
All right, bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And, yeah, first segment has flowed. Time, I think we get into sort of a bit of a time warp, and time just gets away from us. So, yeah, we'll be right back after these here messages.
The Panic Room Radio Show is sponsored by Hellbound Books, purveyors of all manner of dark fiction. You can find the publisher along with links to all their available works across platforms at hellboundbookspublishing.com. Hellbound Books is proud to be the first in the indie publishing business with their very own app on both Google Play and the App Store. In the mood for something steamy to read, check out new erotica author Jennifer Lynn's website at jenniferlynnerotica.com. You can find James at his website, www.jameslongmore.com, and Xtina has an author page found on the Hellbound website. Don't forget to follow the Panic Room Radio Show on social media. Our Facebook page, Unofficial The Panic Room Radio Show, Twitter at Panic Room Radio, our YouTube channel, The New Panic Room Radio Show, and come visit our website at www.panicroomradio.com.
Welcome back to part two.
Well, 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 the Walker Brothers set, one of my favorite, all-time favorites of all time there. So now we have, this is easy time for Steve and I, because we did pre-record our next segment. So I don't know, what are you going to do, Steve? Crack open another bottle of wine? I think she's already started it, bless her. So.
I had my phone on mute just then, but nothing.
You have one job. One job.
I know.
So, I'm going to hit the button to hide Xtina's embarrassment. Listen to how good we are. So, off we go.
Our next guest is horror author Jonathan Janz.
Jonathan, how are you this evening?
I am much better after that round of applause. I feel great now.
We're doing good. We're still here and still doing this nonsense after far too long, to be honest. I mean, how many years have we been doing this now? It was only going to be for a couple of weeks. I actually tried to duck out after a few weeks. She wouldn't let me. So here we are. Like, I think it's like 4 years later, we're still doing it. It's like, oh, goodness sake.
Able to escape. That's good.
Well, you know, in a way, I think it's probably more sad, actually. You know, the sad thing is, this is the highlight of my week. I mean, that's just, which is tragic when you think about it, you know. But there you go. But anyway, Jonathan Janz is here to talk to us about his book, The Raven. She hasn't bothered to put a tagline, so, you know, apologies for that.
Not a problem.
So, obviously, The Raven, you got some big shoes to fill with that title. So tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, I think every author, at least every horror author, wants to destroy the world once or twice. And so this is the first time I've done it. So this is my stab at a post-apocalyptic novel. And the idea of the novel is that there's a group of geneticists and anthropologists and others who feel that mankind is about ready to incinerate the world in nuclear war, which unfortunately isn't that far-fetched. And as a preemptive strike, they decide they're going to go underground, but before doing so, they're going to detonate these bombs at strategic places, which will unlock the DNA that has been dormant in mankind for millennia. And the anthropologists have posited that because there are certain myths in all cultures, like shapeshifter myths, vampire myths, cannibalism, that they were all once real. And this DNA that has been identified as junk DNA is actually full of monstrous strands that only need awakened. So that's what these bombs and the substance that is emitted from the bombs accomplishes. So within a month, either humans have been murdered by the monsters that have been aroused, the people have transformed. They've either been transformed into monsters or they have been killed by the monsters. And so the novel takes place 2 years after this cataclysmic event, and very few people are left alive who don't have these monstrous abilities. And one of them is my main character. And so he is trying to make his way in a world full of monsters in which basically every other normal human has been killed.
Wow. There you go. I love the premise. That's great. What inspired that?
Yeah, I really enjoyed Stephen King is my favorite author of all time. He's the guy who got me into reading, the guy who got me into writing. And I think that he described the Dark Tower series as getting behind this, like, God Almighty, like steam shovel, instead of just using, you know, a little hand tool. And I think that the enormity of the world, like the grandeur of it, really appealed to me, because I love the human side, the intimate side of horror. And I think a lot of my stories are really like that. Like The Nightmare Girl is about like one man and his family, so it's kind of a small universe. But I think I really like the idea of painting on a larger canvas. And this is a planned series. This is the first book of a planned series. So that idea, that notion really, but of course I needed an idea grand enough to support that a series. But I feel like this definitely is that. And I embarked on it, and I'm planning on writing the second book probably later this summer. So I think that's probably what called to me, is the idea of doing something on a much grander scale.
Wow, that's awesome. Awesome. And you say you're planning a series. I mean, do you know how big that series is going to be, or is it just it'll take you where it takes you?
Yeah, I think it's going to take me where it takes me. I'm definitely planning on doing at least two or three books. I have the second one fairly plotted out in my head. I mean, just like ideas for the second book. And then I have a notion of where it could go from there. But part of it will be just dependent on what else I'm writing in my career. And also, mm-hmm. I think that, you know, you want, there needs to be fan demand. So if fans enjoy it, if readers enjoy it, then that will help fuel that as well. There are certain books that never would have been, I don't normally sequelize. I think most of my books are standalone. But I think that the more readers, you know, really crave a furthering of the story, that certainly becomes a factor, because you want that. I think that that enthusiasm kind of helps a writer. At least it helps me.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great. Admirable. And it's nice that you're grounded enough to, take a view on reader demand, I guess. You know, I know some authors who just keep slogging away, and you know, they get churning stuff out, and they're just not getting anywhere. But because it's their vision, I think in one respect it's admirable, because that's you're damn well going to stick with it. But you know, you need to. I suppose it depends what you want from your market, from your writing. You know, if you want to make some money, or you know, just, then you know, if look at what your readers are doing. If they're not reading, then maybe do something else for a little bit. Now, but that's just me. Maybe I'm just too mercenary for my own good. You know.
I
like the destroy the world. I mean, something I haven't tackled. Yeah, I just find it daunting. You know, I'm like you, and I like the smaller, the more intimate horror. Just the thought of trying to, you know, deal with the whole world just frightens me to death. I mean, how do you tackle something like that?
Well, here, this is a little paradoxical and probably contradictory sounding, but I kind of did that by narrowing the lens, at least here at first. So it's beginning with one man, and then as the story goes on, it's kind of like, you know, any kind of epic journey. You begin, like we began Star Wars. I just watched that the other night, and we began really with a pair of droids, and then we have mm-hmm. Luke added to the mix, and then eventually Luke meets Obi-Wan. And then they uh-huh. go to the Mos Eisley Cantina, and then Han Solo and Chewbacca, and then once there's the Death Star, Princess Leia joins. And really, this kind of has a similar kind of acquisition of characters as we go. But I begin with a pretty narrow lens. I begin with a single mm-hmm. character, and then by the end, we've acquired more. You know, one cool thing, I've been reading, I don't read all reviews, but I've been reading some of the early reviews. They've been really positive. Any criticisms that I've found so far have mainly been, like, they feel like the book creates more questions than it answers. And to a degree, that's by design, right? Because I do mm-hmm. plan on making this a larger world. And I think in a grand, like, for example, if you look at The Gunslinger by Stephen King, there's no way he could answer all questions in The Gunslinger. And then if you go back and you look at that through the lens of the whole series, you realize that, this was just an introduction to a few characters, and then the world expands and expands and expands as it goes on. And I plan on doing the same thing.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I'm always impressed by any writer who plans a series. I find that just daunting. You know, I just haven't found my subject yet, but this could be a great, you know, 3, 4, 5 book series. Maybe I just haven't got there yet. No, good luck to you, because it's one thing, you know, you sit down to write a novel. No, well, this is going to be, you know, 80 to 100,000 words, but you multiply that by 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I mean, I could be a third to half a million words stretching ahead of me. That would, that, if anything, that would probably just disincentivize me to do anything. I would just be in a state of, my brain would just like, no, I'm not going to do that. No, forget it. You're on your own, bucko. You know.
Right. No, I agree. I think
characters. Yeah, you definitely, if you find your characters, you know, the characters that you can keep going on with, and, you know, I think that definitely makes a difference. And, you know, I don't know, James, you said that, you know, it's not for you, whatever, but I have definitely read some of your characters that I think that could definitely, you know, go on. You know, we can definitely hear more from them, but,
yeah, you're also going to say a lot of my characters all end up dead anyway, so there's really not much for doing anything with them because they're dead now. You killed them all in the last book. Oh, yeah, there is that. But,
right, that is a limiting factor.
You know, I've sort of toyed with it. I think for me, I've got that many different ideas that I just like to do, maybe, you know, for Pede, my centipede creature novel, you know, I sort of thought I could actually do two sequels. Again, just take the giant centipedes and just stick them in different. I've got one where they're on a let loose on a cruise ship, for example. But you know, there's only so many ways you can kill people with giant centipedes, you know. And I just like, well, I have other things I want to do than giant. But having said that, if Pede suddenly became a multi-million bestseller, I would write centipede novels till the end of time. Not a problem.
Sure.
So it's like, I don't know if you're familiar with James Herbert, Jonathan, who's a great British. He was like my introduction to grown-up horror, and The Rats was the first grown-up horror that I read. Brilliant. Of course, The Rats was his big breakthrough. Then he did The Lair, then he did Domain, then he actually did a graphic novel as well, The City, which was great. You know, but again, because that was his thing. So maybe if giant centipedes took off the way as rats. I mean, the Pede is actually my homage to James Herbert. So I always wanted to write that creature novel. And I could never think of a creature that hadn't been done to death. And of course, that popped up. And away we go. So anyways, a neat segue. The Raven, do you have an excerpt for us?
I absolutely do, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I we always say that, and I've got it here in front of me, so I did know, to be honest. But it's all part of the illusion that I've now shattered for the listener. So, I mean, if you it's from chapter 4. If you need to set it up, and then the airwaves are yours, sir.
Awesome. That's what I'll do. Thank you. So, I wanted to read something for you that hadn't been read before anywhere else, and instead of just, you know, reading the same chapters over and over. So, essentially, this is chapter 4. It's very early in the novel. And the only thing that's happened thus far, the main thing that's happened is Dez McLean, my main character, he's the one without any powers. He has met with three other latents, which is what I call a regular person. They're called latents because their abilities aren't expressed yet, but in fact they probably have no abilities. One of them named Gentry ended up surviving the ordeal. The other two were killed by a trio of cannibals. And the cannibals, one of whom Dez ended up murdering, the other two, Paul and Stomper, these really ferocious cannibals, Dez and Gentry ended up escaping. So this is a scene in the aftermath of those first three chapters where they face the cannibals, two other characters are killed brutally, Dez kills one cannibal, and now they've been on the run from the other two, who are Paul and Stomper, and now Dez and Gentry have kind of slowed down, they're making camp for the night, but Dez starts to have a suspicion that all was not as it seemed. So the scene we're going to read is called By the Fire, chapter 4. And you want me to get going here?
Yeah, you go for it. The airwaves are yours, sir. Off you go.
All right. Cool. Here we go. Luck was with them for once. When Dez was convinced they'd reached a safe distance from Paul and Stomper, they slowed to an enervated walk. While the dawn wasn't warm enough to take the edge off the constant breeze, the dishwater sky made it possible to build a small fire at the summit of a tree-lined hill. In short order, Dez shot a squirrel with his crossbow. The two of them sat eating before the fire. Watching him there, shoulders slumped and chest heaving with labored breath, Dez wondered how the hell Gentry had managed to stay alive this long when so many better men had been slain by predators. I'm going to be censoring some of the language, by the way, because I'm a teacher in real life. But anyway, here we go. Dez shook his head, marveling. The heap of branches they'd scrounged seethed orange and black like some pagan Halloween ritual. Dez scarcely noticed, because a thought had snagged in his brain, and as always happened when a thought took hold, he was utterly incapable of dismissing it until his overactive mind was satisfied. He peered at Gentry from the corners of his eyes and wondered how such a scrawny creature could have lasted 2 years. 2 years! Dez had flirted with death on too many occasions to number, one of them less than a month ago. And though Dez wasn't as powerful as, say, a cannibal or a werewolf, for a latent, he knew he was respectable. He could shoot. He could run. He could defend himself when the situation called. But this man, this scarecrow, could barely thread a sharpened stick through a hunk of squirrel meat. How could Gentry have survived in this sick, violent world? Then it hit him. He couldn't have. Keeping his tone measured, Dez said, "Before you mess up everything." "What's that?" Gentry asked in a faraway voice. He was gazing hungrily at the frying squirrel meat as though it were the last morsel of food on the planet. "When I first saw you in the clearing," Dez went on, "you said to move on before I messed up everything." Had a fearful expression flitted across Gentry's face. "Those man-eating sons of bitches were what I was referring to." He shook his head soberly. "They'd been after us for the better part of 2 days." "How'd you manage to keep ahead of them? That big one moved like a storm cloud." Gentry grinned, his teeth yellow and specked with brown. "Fast dude, wasn't he? For such a big guy?" Studied his hank of squirrel. "Shoot, man, I still can't believe we got away." "Because I saved you." Gentry's eyes flicked to Dez. "You did at that. Mighty impressive." His expression darkened, the pale eyes unseeing. "Hope it doesn't bring the wrath of God down on our heads." Gentry grunted humorlessly. "Course, most would say he's already shown us his wrath." Dez frowned, slowly rotated his stick, the aroma of cooked meat wafting over him, making his saliva glands squirt. Hunger, he thought. Always the hunger. Gentry turned his stick over, the squirrel meat charred on one side. "Before," Dez said. Gentry appeared not to have heard. "Before the cannibals showed up." Gentry looked at him. "Come again?" But Dez had grown very still, his own length of squirrel meat hissing and bubbling fat and dripping into the fire. Gentry shook his head. "I thought we was goners for sure. That stomper, he don't leave many folks behind. What's the saying? Dead men don't tell tales. Why did he kill the boy and his father first?" Something new came into Gentry's eyes. "Just lucky, I guess. You'd rather he offed one of us?" "You were closer." Now Gentry did turn his full attention on him, and the smile became flinty. "At first I was, sure. Look, would you rather I stayed there front and center like a..." He trailed off, seeing Dez's expression. "What are you trying to say? I'd soon enough hear it." "They never went for you." "Hell, they didn't." He brought up an elbow, tapping it with a quaking finger. "Threw me down's what they did. Killed me if I hadn't..." "Out of the way," Dez muttered to himself. "How's that?" Stared into the fire, his skin taut. "Paul, the archer, he threw you out of the way." Gentry was on his feet, moving faster than Dez had seen him move, and gestured down the length of his body. "Oh, yeah? And who can blame that big bastard for casting me aside? Would you want a bag of bones like this, or a boy in the prime of his..." "They weren't following me." Gentry's eyes narrowed. "What the hell are you talking about?" "They were following the trail, but they weren't following me." Dez looked up at Gentry. "They were meeting someone." Gentry's mouth worked. His eyes flitted to the left as though he considered fleeing. "I don't know what you got against an old man, but I got enough on my plate without you..." That's how you've stayed alive. Damn you, boy! You've had your brain scrambled. How many? Gentry's scowl deepened. How many what? How many people have you gotten killed? Hell with this, Gentry said, lifting his stick, which glowed a brilliant red. They say they're protecting you, but the only reason the cannibals let you live is because you lure food for them. Damn you, I'll tell you something. Gentry swung the blazing branch at Dez's face. Dez just had time to throw up an arm before the fiery tip smacked his leather sleeve and sparks exploded over Dez's face like an errant firework. Angry wasps stung his temple, but he couldn't worry about that because the seething red tip was flicking back at him, at the side of his face. Dez had no time to protect himself, so he thrust himself backward off the log, the fiery tip tracing an icy line from his underjaw to his earlobe. Stomper! Gentry bellowed. Pull! Dez completed the backward roll, came up with his machete, but Gentry wasn't coming for him, was scurrying toward the edge of the summit, hands cupped around his mouth, his voice lusty and more resonant than it had been all morning. Stomper! He shouted. You gotta get up here! Gentry's head swiveled around, but by that time Dez was halfway to him and closing, the machete gripped in his right hand. Now don't you even think about... Gentry's mouth snapped shut, apparently realizing it was beyond keeping the fiction alive. Without another word, he darted down the slope, and as Dez gave chase, he saw how nimble Gentry was, how well he navigated the hillocks and washouts. Earlier, Dez had been too fearful of the cannibals to notice, but now that he saw Gentry moving, he couldn't believe how dull-witted he'd been not to see it before.
Oh, we're going to cut you off. And I hate that.
No, that's a good place to stop.
It was, you read that incredible, I was living that. I was absolutely living that. That was great.
Well, thank you.
I'm going to read on. That was fantastic. So, do you have a, this as an audio book?
Not yet, but I think it will be an audio book. I think it'll be a simultaneous audio release.
Yeah. If so, you need to read it yourself. Do the reading. Don't
well,
trust it
so
to anyone.
Nice.
You were brilliant. I like that.
Well, that means the world to me. Thank you. I appreciate it. I've never done an audio book. I'm a teacher, so I read with my students. Like, we'll go back and forth. I'll pick on a kid, and then he and I will read, or she and I will read back and forth. So I do a lot of reading aloud in the stories we do, but I've never done an audio book.
What subject do you teach?
I teach English, creative writing, and film literature.
Well, I'm going to ask you a funny before we came on air. I was having a chat with my daughter. She's a fifth grader. She's 11. She was telling about who she's going to miss from, because with all this, she's going to miss saying goodbye to her elementary school, because when they do finally go back, she's going to be in middle school. But she said they got a new art teacher. She doesn't like the new art teacher because the art teacher sets them a task and then will tell them it's wrong if it doesn't look exactly as the art teacher has done it. Then it's wrong. Now, again, you teach a creative subject, and I said to my daughter that she is incorrect. If it was math, if it was physics, if it was a science, whatever, there's right and there's wrong.
Right.
But with something creative, with its art, with its writing, to some extent, music I guess. Speak as a teacher, Jonathan. I mean, would you agree with me or the teacher? I mean, is it her place to say no, you've done that wrong, or what?
Well, I don't know the class or the teacher, but all I can tell you is how I approach my creative writing and film lit classes, where they make movies and they write stories. And man, like, to do something to make it homogenous, that's our enemy. I don't want, if I've got 25 kids, I want 25 different voices, 25 different sensibilities, 25 different lenses. I don't want them to look alike at all. In everything we do, whenever we workshop, whenever they share stories, I tell them, look, listen to your partner. If he or she comes up with something, maybe it's just something like a quotation mark misplaced or a period where there should be a comma. Sure, listen to each other, but in the end, it's your story and it's your vision.
Yeah.
And I don't want you to sound like each other. I don't want you to sound like me. I mean, think about how selfishly, how boring would that be for me to grade 25 stories that are identical?
Geez.
That would be
exactly
horrific.
Yeah.
That'd be disgusting.
Well,
I
said to my daughter, I said, well, you know, okay, what if somebody said to Picasso, look, that's rubbish. That is rubbish.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Do it again. It doesn't look like a person. Just seriously, Picasso, get out. Get out of my class. You know, you're terrible. But you know, it is in the eye of the beholder, because, you know, there's no right or wrong, no good or bad. You know, I said to people, abstract artwork, people pay hundreds of millions of pounds for these things. So, sorry, dollars.
Exactly.
Sorry, my Britishism slipping in there. You know.
No, that's great.
So yeah. I'm glad. By pure happenstance, got to chat to a teacher. But yeah, I was just saying, when I did creative writing when I was at school, you know, we were allowed, they would give you the subject and do with it what you will, off you go, and put your own spin on it.
Absolutely.
However, and I always enjoyed that. Always enjoyed. It was one of my favorite class.
Seriously.
So.
Yeah, anybody, not just in fiction and art, not just in the arts, but think about all professions. Think about who rises to the top or who's the most interesting. It is the person who thinks originally. All right. So at every moment, that sort of thinking should be cultivated and celebrated, certainly not suppressed. That's really dispiriting for me to hear. I'm sorry to go through that, but I'm glad at least you're telling us.
Well, I'm fairly comfortable with my. I mean, Christina sort of knows my daughter from speaking to her on the air a couple of times. You know, she's very well, much. You know, she knows enough to know that's BS. You know what I mean? She knows that, and she still does what she wants. You know, she's not a rebel or anything, but you know, she's a very creative. She gets my sort of creative genes. So she knows. You know, I will. You know, I will show my creativity and to hell with it, you know. And but there must be a lot of other children who are sort of beaten down by that and think, well, it's not okay. The lesson learned is unless you are, like you say, unless you conform, you are not, you know, you're not doing it right, which is terrible.
No,
this is why we end up with 9 Transformers movies and untold... you know, Marvel and DC movies instead of originality, you're just getting the same old crap churned out and churned out and churned out, you know, this is where it all starts, I think.
People don't do anything different.
Yeah, so you said you're a big Stephen King fan. First of all, which is your favorite Stephen King book? We have to ask.
That's painful. That's difficult for me. I love So Many so much. And even though it's probably not his best written book, Salem's Lot has a special place in my heart. Just because of the overall vibe, that it's just so, I feel such dread as I read it. So that's probably my favorite, even though it's probably, I mean, it's still wonderfully written, but I think he's really grown as an author. And I think the stuff he's writing now is as good as anything he's ever written personally. But as far as stories, I'd see the Salem's Lot of the Stand.
What about you? It was the first King novel I read. The first Stephen King I read was, Night Shift, the short story collection?
It's so good.
And Salem's Lot.
I got
Night Shift, Salem's Lot, and The Stand, and I read them in that order. And Salem's Lot is, I think, it's for me, it's between that and It. I mean, I love that.
Oh, nice.
I love that book on so many levels. But again, I mean, like you said, it is a difficult question. I mean, Firestarter and Christine were a couple of really good ones as well. You know, I think a lot of his early stuff was just brilliant. Each one was just out there on its own. You know, it was Pet Sematary, of course, was a phenomenal one.
Yeah. So
I think I'm an oddball. I think one of my favorite Stephen King books is The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. I think it was great. I love that. And it was like the shortest one, which when I was younger and I went to go pick out a book to, you know, buy or read, I picked out the thickest one I could find. And but I thought it was a great book. It's my favorite. I've read it a few times. And
Do you still read the pop-up? I found it in a little local bookstore that I'm kind of friendly with around here. I actually found the pop-up version of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. I've got to get this. Xtina has to have this. I only read it because Xtina was going on and on and on and on and on about it. And I read it. And it's a neat little story. Little girl. It's literally, you know, he said it took about a microcosm. It's one girl throughout most of the book. Stuck in a forest. And this is what King does best for me. It's like, which was the one where the woman was tied to the bed? Gerald's Game. Which for most of the book was a woman handcuffed to the bed, and it was incredibly well done, you know, and it just, that he gets into people's minds so efficiently. It's scary. I mean, it really is scary how he does it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, so, So is it King that inspired you to write, or is it something you've, that predates that? Yeah.
King, actually, I think he really saved me in a lot of ways. He saved my self-esteem because I just had no confidence as a 14-year-old kid when I picked up one of his books. For me, the first book I read is actually one of King's least favorites. It's called The Tommyknockers. And King, mm-hmm. I don't think he disavows it, but it's certainly not on his list of favorites.
I've read where he said that he hates it.
Yeah, he does. But for me, of course, I didn't know that at the time. So for me, it was transformative.
Right.
And it is what set me on the path to become, I was a reader for the first time. That was the first book I ever read.
Wow.
It set me on the path to becoming a writer. I started to write when I was 18, just fitfully. I mean, not seriously. So I didn't become serious until my 30s. But then it also set me on the path to becoming an English teacher because I really became fell in love with words. And that's because of Stephen King, because of that one book. So I will forever be in. I'm dying to meet him, man. That's like, you know, people, I don't like bucket lists, but if I have a bucket list, I got to meet him at some point just to tell him how much he's meant to me at some point. Because he absolutely changed my life. Yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, it's funny, James Herbert had the same effect on me. You know, I read The
Herbert's
Rats off. And then read the Fog, and it just plowed through the dark and, you know, a lot of in his later career, he went towards the more spiritual and the ghost and that sort of thing. But he's early. I mean, he's credited as being the father of splatterpunk. But they were just graduating from the kiddies sort of horror books to The Rats, which was visceral, and the sex scenes were graphic, and it was just brutal, and there were puppies in it, and it was just like. But it was so. In fact, I actually bought myself an early edition about 2 years ago because I just had to have it. I've got to have The Rats. And I read it again. I'm not one for reading books more than once, you know. And I read it again, and it still stands up. You know, and it was from the mid late 70s. It still stands up. Obviously, he got better and better and better. And, you know, I think one of my favorite of Herbert's was The Spear.
Which I was going to say, when I was in high school. Yeah. The Spear is amazing. I also love Survivor. The Survivor, whatever it is. So good.
Survivor was good. Did you see the movie with Robert Powell in it? It was a very surreal movie. It was good, but it was.
I did not.
Yeah.
I think I need to, probably. I know Herbert's so fan. He's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, he's. But then from him, I went to King. From King, it's actually through Stephen King I discovered Clive Barker because I was just browsing my local bookstore. And it's funny, on the Books of Blood, you know, there's a Stephen King quote saying, "I've seen the future of horror," and his name is Clive Barker. If it's good enough for King, it's good enough for me. And funny enough about him, because I always wanted to write, you know, and I dabbled as a kid and growing up. And I read all six Books of Blood. I was sort of mid 20s, and that stopped me writing for about 6 years because I thought I could never. Matt, he was just so original, so incredibly well written, just beautiful, beautiful writing, great ideas. And you know, I compared that with the short stories I've been writing, I'd been them. I'm not even worthy to be mentioned in the same sentence of Clive Barker. So I'm a big, big Clive Barker fan as well, obviously. Found my confidence again and realised that you don't get to be as good as Clive Barker with your first story. You've got to work on it, you know?
Yeah, no, so, I get that. I get intimidated sometimes too. He's incredible. Yeah, you talked about his originality is so blazing. Like In the Hills, The Cities was a story in the Book of Blood, like Midnight.
That's
a totally original story, right? I mean, that's nobody. I don't think anybody had done that before.
No.
But I totally agree. I think, you know, Chuck Wendig is this writer. He's on Twitter all the time, and he's written for all kinds of stuff. One thing he said, he has this article that says 25 things a great character needs. And I always remember this, and this is something I tell my students, and something like your daughter, you would believe and your daughter would believe. And he says that the 25th ingredient that a great character needs is you. And, like, mm-hmm. he needs you to bring, because you bring your unique perspective, your unique lens. And that's something, as great as Clive Barker is, as great as James Herbert and Stephen King are, they can't bring me, right? Only I can bring that sensibility because I have a unique lens. And that thought really is heartening and, I think, motivating for me. Because, you and I can't write like Clive Barker, but then again, nobody can write like Clive Barker. Nobody can replicate what he does, nor do we need to, nor should we aspire to, right? We should aspire to be what we are and then maximize that. But it takes a while, I think, for a young writer to get that.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, obviously, everybody wants to be, instead of trying to be the next Stephen King, you know, try and be the first you, you know. we get submissions day in, day out. Obviously, we speak to all authors, you know, and we see it so much. You know, this person is just trying too hard to be Stephen King, you know, or whoever, even, you know, and it just doesn't work, you know. It's just like you say. That's the and hopefully you impart that to your students. You know, just be you. You know, write as you, put a little bit of you in everything you do, and be true to your own voice. And I think that is probably the only bit of advice you really need to give a writer.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree. We are just out of time for our show today, and
too
fast. Jonathan, you have to. Promise to come back and see us.
I would love to. 100%, I would love to again.
Yeah,
thank you for having me, by the way. I've had a blast.
No, the pleasure is ours. Thank you so. Yeah, you must go. We must. We have to do. We'll have to do a full show for you next time. Obviously, do more. It'd be great to do a show on hints and tips for writers, because obviously, from your perspective, you teach creative writing. That'd be fantastic to get that, because I know we get a lot of writers listening, and you know, I think they would get a lot from it. That'd be great. So you must promise to do that soon.
I promise. It would be amazing.
Okay.
I would love to do it. Anytime you want, I'll be here.
But yeah, Christina will stalk you that much, I can promise.
I will.
So you've been warned. You may wish to move.
Awesome.
Okay, Jonathan, you have a great rest of your evening, and we'll speak to you soon. Bye.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And, time has beaten us, Xtina, I'm afraid. And it is that time. You know the drill, where we have to say goodnight, Xtina.
Goodnight, Xtina.